right. I am here with an unusual show because I'm here with Amish Patel.
What's that?
Amish is, here he is. He's a Canadian Screen Award winner with the Writers Guild of Canada, a stand-up comic, and he's also the dad on a show called Dino Dana, if any of you are watching it. I have people in my house that are obsessed with dinosaurs, and we're quite big fans of the show, so thank you for that, Amish. But fun. I wanted to, but the reason I know Amish's work is from his YouTube channel, but also this podcast that you're often on called CoffeeZilla, and you guys have a special series called The Laughing Babas, where you basically kind of dissect what he calls fake gurus.
And yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
you know, gurus, you know, you got to have an Indian guy talking about gurus.
It's a, yeah, yeah. We invented that word. Same with pundits. Like all these pundits is like an Indian word. It's a Hindu word.
Thugs, pundits, thugs, the word thug, the word loot.
Indian, yeah, yeah.
Loot. Loot is also Indian. So like when our dads tell us like everything comes from India, it's not entirely untrue.
It's the Asian countries will rise, brother. I mean, they were in charge for 1,000 years. That's why China calls this the century of shame, because in their minds they're like, what are these Americans? Yeah. Like, we were in charge for 1,000 years.
Yeah, you know, the GDP, right? When the GDP, like 200 years ago, India and China each had 25% of the share of the global GDP, and now, and like by the end of the, by the 20th century, they were in the 3 and 4%. So
yeah, they were the first big empires, I think, and they want to reclaim their place again as the big empires. And I think they look
well. You know, the way China puts it is they want a multipolar world, right? They don't want the world to be just America. What America said.
That's step one.
That's their word. That's what they're saying.
We want a multipolar world, so we're just going to take over the South China Sea. You know, multipolar world.
It's called the South China Sea, right? It's not called the South U.S. Sea. It makes sense that they don't want the Americans there, doesn't it?
Sure. I mean, the Americans are there. Look, it's two evils versus each other. Like, I'm not trying to say that one's better than the other, but they're both, like, I think they're both colonizers. They won't both want to be in charge of the world. They won't both want to have military bases everywhere or whatever it is. I mean, the moves that China's making into Pakistan, into Europe, even the way they're buying up ports.
Don't you think that if the world right now is one where there's like 170 U.S. countries with U.S. bases, doesn't it give the rest of the world a little more room to maneuver for there to be one or two other powers than for there to just be one, and you have to take the deal the Americans give you? That's kind of how I see it.
Sure, like, sure. Yeah, no, you gotta make the powers compete. You know, we were just talking about meat. Sure, they have to compete, but let's not say that one's the nice one and one's the evil one. They're both vicious.
In 2013, I traveled to Afghanistan and then to Kashmir. I was in India. I was at Jamia. I was teaching a class at Jamia Millia Islamia in Delhi.
Okay.
And that's like it's kind of an interesting place because it's like conceived as a Muslim university, but it was like their idea of, you know, the Indian idea of like, this is Muslim, but it's secular, you know, it's not Islamist. It's like Muslim, but you're still Indian.
Yeah.
And that was, it's like a, you know, the idea of a kind of an inclusive place. And recently you can imagine the Indian government has, you know, conducted raids and beaten people up there and gassed it and everything.
No, everyone's being harsh to the Muslims, I think, right now. Well, it is like India and this caste system where they were in a special position where they get to be in charge of other people, you know? So it's kind of like when, you know, Arundhati Roy, she criticizes Gandhi. And I think the criticism of Gandhi is he basically got the keys back for the old caste system. So,
yeah, you know, because there was a critic of the caste, like Ambedkar was the real critic of the caste system, right? Yeah. And he was one of the, he wrote the constitution and, but he, you know, he argued, I don't know what you think of this, but he basically argued that Indians were obsessed with caste because of their religion.
Yeah.
So he thought that people who were untouchable should convert to Buddhism. And he had these mass ceremonies where people converted to Buddhism because he was like, Hinduism offers nothing to
fair enough
to Dalits, right?
Same with Islam. Like, I mean, I have family in India right now, and they're saying these guys are converting to Islam, and they have no loyalty. It's like, what is this loyalty?
what are you giving them?
You're giving them nothing, man. I mean, what, you're demanding loyalty to be your slave? It's ridiculous. Hinduism has different sides of it. It has slavery built into it on one half.
Yeah.
But on the other half, it has that Buddhist side, and the Buddhist side is the most advanced.
That's the thing about India, right? India has everything. Like, India has just every single thing. Like, you can't really be for India or against India, because India has slavery and freedom and, you know, like oppression and liberation, like everything.
I lived there for 2 years too. And I remember they would always talk about this in school. They would talk about the need for loyalty and how we don't have loyalty to each other and whatever. And it's like, you're demanding loyalty.
Can I ask which 2 years, and also where were you?
Grade 9 and 10. I was in school in Gujarat.
Okay. In Ahmedabad or?
No. It's like a village and they have an English school. But it was a village where a lot of people left to Africa. So they were rich.
They were going back and forth to Tanzania and Kenya.
Yeah,
probably.
They had that vibe. They still have that vibe. That village, it's like the Paris of India or something. Like they're very like, you know, just the stories I heard about Africa when I was a kid. They would tell these stories.
I've been to Kenya, and I met like Indian businessmen in Kenya too. So that was also interesting.
They're colonizers.
I mean, it's all the British Empire, right? The British Empire moves people around, like, you know, Chinese laborers built the railway here, like, you know, bring agricultural workers there, slaves.
What do you think of Uganda? Like, have you heard the story of how they sent over people to run Uganda?
Yeah, there was. I've only very recently like learned a little bit about this because I have a friend who's like researching the British Empire and like racism in the British Empire, like how they thought of race and racism.
Wow,
and that's great. Yeah, so
we had a podcast.
So, like, yeah, there was a time for a while. There was a time when they were basically like, maybe we'll incorporate Indians as like a in between, like not as good as white people and not. You know, not as bad as, you know, not as oppressed as black people.
Yeah, they were the management. Like,
yeah, they'll run middle racial middle management.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. It's basically the lighter you are, the higher you go. So they bring a bunch of Indian people over there. They're like, well, these guys should be in charge. They're closer to us.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say I recently just learned about this too. And the guy told me that they put Indian people in charge, but then they took the like a poor minority and put them like second. They made them like military and police. So it was like Indian administrators, and then military and police is the people that were being oppressed by them for whatever. That's the tribe that Uganda's named after. So they eventually just did a military coup, took over the country, kicked out the Indian people. But it's called Uganda because it's that tribe that is actually in charge now.
Yeah. Yeah. So there were three different regimes, right? There was like Milton Obote, and then he was overthrown by Idi Amin, and Idi Amin is the one who expelled the Indians.
Yeah.
And then Obote replaced him again. Tanzania actually intervened and overthrew Idi Amin, and then Obote came back, and then Obote was overthrown in turn by a guy named Yoweri Museveni. So yeah, there were different, but the one who actually threw the Indians out was Idi Amin. And Idi Amin was not good in all kinds of ways.
Oh, no. I mean, what are you going to do? So, you've created a system of like...
Yeah.
He's a product of the empire, I think, you know?
That's where right.
They're
That's
pitting right. everyone against each other. They're almost funding like the local militia groups more than anyone and honoring them and raising them up because that's who they need their loyalty to run the rest of the country.
Yeah. And even the whole idea of like tribalism, right? Which is like... only really talked about in Africa as if, you know, as if nations, you know, are not tribes, like as if Germany is not a tribe or France is not a tribe, but like the Acholi or the Baganda are tribes, right? Yeah. Yeah.
Or when someone's being difficult, then they're being tribal, you know what I mean? It's like here, if someone has different political opinions, it's like, hey, you're being tribal. versus, you know, and just fighting for no reason. And it's like, the country is a big tribe, if you think about it. It's a big culture, I guess. It's defined by that.
Well, yeah, and it's also like useful, right? Like if you want to be the leader of a tribe, then obviously it's better if people think in terms of loyalty to the tribe, because that translates into loyalty to you.
Yeah, yeah, you got to brainwash everyone. That's the key. It's a big, like, convince them that you're better and you're ordained by God. That was a big thing with the Brits. They were good at. They had people in India. I remember I saw a thing where people in India were buying statues of Queen Victoria, but big, expensive ones. Mm-hmm. They would just pay for it independently. So the statues in India of Queen Victoria, they're not even all from the British. A lot of it is just local kings being like, I want that favor.
You know,
I want that prosperity of a Queen Victoria here.
Well, yeah. And, you know, there were all these, like, I wrote this book about basically U.S. intervention in Central Africa and Congo and Rwanda. And in the 60s, there were these mercenaries, and they would laugh at, you know, how the Congolese that they were fighting, they had all these mystical beliefs, you know, like that white people were invincible and stuff. And it's like, you've been telling them that, though. Like, you were doing that to them for 80 years. They're going to be a little intimidated now. It's going to take them something to.
Yeah. I mean, if you've never seen guns before and they even just come with that, it's like, oh, they have magic. What?
It's a loud sound. Yeah. And it is. How is it not magic? Like, any technology is magic if you don't. Okay, exactly. But you know, the reason I wanted to talk to you 13 minutes in is because I watched those videos that you did about like Jocko Willink and Extreme Ownership and Jordan Peterson. And I was just thinking, like, I went through like some of these also, like, they're kind of gurus in a way, right? We don't call them that in the West.
Totally they're gurus. I mean, he's running a platoon. So to his boys, he's Babaji. He's Ram Ram. Number one is Jocko.
So the first, but let's do Jordan first, because the first thing that struck me, like the reason I like clicked on your video and then I wanted to keep watching, was because you noticed something that I noticed, which obviously we would notice, which is that like so many of the people that follow him are Indian.
Of course.
What the hell's going on? Why do you think that is?
Because we're nerds. We're like obedient school kids. I mean, it's changing now. When I went to school in India, I remember the first class, I couldn't believe it. They were all telling on each other. Like a teacher would come in and say, who did this one? Who did like this? And please. They're all ratting each other out. Now I just found out, my cousin just came from the school that I went to. When I was there, they just stopped hitting kids. Two, 3 years before. He told me that they just stopped corporal punishment. Like when I was there, they were doing corporal punishment.
Is this what? This is 15 years ago, 12 years ago, something like this?
Grade 9 and 10. So I don't know. It's been it's a long time, maybe 20 years. But whatever. When I was in grade 9 and 10, I'm there. Yeah. And the first year was like abusive, you know, but the second year was like Lord of the Flies, man. They were just like, we were just, basically people were mad that like, well, how dare you take away hitting kids? And so
I'm trying to figure out what, like, who the government was. This must have been in the 90s too, right? Like,
90s for sure. 100% it was in the 90s, maybe mid 90s or definitely in the 90s. But
some Congress government.
But I do see now. I've heard, so my cousin just told me that he came back from the same school. They just have corporal punishment, and he was saying that if a teacher hits a kid, they might get beat up after class then. Like the teacher might.
The
kids might all be outside waiting with the government person, like child services, to be like, hey, this guy hit me. Put him, you know what I mean? Like he's going
to
suffer.
So things are really starting to change. But I mean, when you were there in the 90s, India was much, like I noticed, I was there in 2008 and then again in 2013. And there were big changes in between those 5 years.
They're moving
quick. So you wouldn't recognize it now.
I went last time. It was like 10 years ago, I think. And it's getting cooler. It's getting like, you know, it changes so fast. Like technology changes faster than us. It's just so quick. Yeah. And then, you know, it's moving along. And but I think that generation grew up with a idea of like teacher's God and you have to listen to the teacher. So I honestly think like he's teaching a philosophy class, Jordan Peterson here at U of T.
Yeah,
he's teaching a philosophy class. You'd think it would be a bunch of white kids. Where are they? They're fully just like, fuck you, dude. Don't tell me what to do. Like I don't think they're protesting against him. He's got probably five Indian kids in the class, and all five of them are such good boys that they're like, well, I have to go help the Babaji, Shri Ram, Jordan Peterson. I have to go help him probably. You know what I mean? So,
which is interesting because a lot of what he's saying is like maybe traditional values and hierarchy that maybe
he is like an Indian dad for white guys. It's like, it's like that strict upbringing that maybe they're missing that they're, I don't know. I mean, not to say missing though. I'm listening to the book about Trump that Mary L. Trump wrote. I think his niece, and it's all about the toxic upbringing and how much damage it's done. And so I think we have a notion, and this goes again speaking to all three of them: Jordan Peterson, Jocko, and not as much Goggins because I think David Goggins is so sweet in another way. But with Peterson and Jocko,
So that's a lot of really a lot of exercise stuff, right? With Goggins,
He does hurt himself, and I wonder if he would hurt. Yeah, he would. He does advocate for like hurting yourself, but there is something sweet about it. It's like the self sacrifice. I find with Jocko and Jordan Peterson, it's like you need to toughen up because the enemy is coming, and you have to kill them or whatever. And it's like that's. I think that conservative mentality is more damaging than whoever's coming.
Yeah, you know, I listened to I watched that. Did you watch American Dharma? Speaking of Indian,
what's that connection about?
Steve Bannon. Do you know who Steve Bannon was? Steve Bannon, and there's a documentary, basically an hour and a half long interview with Steve Bannon. So, and it came out like last year. It's on Netflix. You should you probably like it. But
Steve Bannon, hour and a half.
Yeah, it's just him. Like, it's just him talking to, you know, the documentarian's Errol Morris. So he interviewed like Robert McNamara and
that sounds lovely.
Donald Rumsfeld.
I'm definitely going to watch that. Steve Bannon.
So Bannon is, you know, he was the advisor to Trump, right? And he's like white nationalism. You know, he goes around advising right-wing governments how to get to power. And he's, you know, like he's famous for like he's at a rally and he's like, you know, they're going to call you a racist and you wear that. You wear that with pride, right? Because he's – so it's like that – Jordan Peterson too. It's like we're not – they're trying to say they're anti-political correctness more than like pro-racism, right? So it's like they find the weakest thing that the left is saying and they seize on that. But their whole agenda is right-wing.
Oh, totally.
Bannon has this like basically like clash of civilizations kind of understanding of the world. Like, you know, we have there's Europe, there's Islam, there's China, and like if we don't beat them, they're gonna beat us.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's like how they see the world, right? Yeah. So it feels like that's behind a lot of what Jordan's saying too, what
and Jocko, like Jocko, for example, is like, because the book is called Extreme Ownership. Sorry to jump over to Jocko, but real quick.
No, it's okay. Gurus, you know.
We're doing all three. We can do all three. Like
Jocko, we can do them. We can jump all over.
Jocko, one of the things he says in his book is you have to engage the enemy. So this is the excuse for endless war. It never ends.
Yeah.
He has a book called Extreme Ownership, and the main story is in Iraq. He doesn't say once that, hey, maybe we should not be in Iraq. What's the extreme ownership? It's just the extreme ownership of you killed a guy. And instead of like his story, the way he sells it and the way he pitches it, because I think there is also on top of protecting.
Let's tell people. Jocko Willink, he's like a Navy SEAL, and then he was served in Iraq. He comes back. He's a big, strong, thick-necked, handsome guy, and he sells lifestyle. So he's like, you know how to live a great life because I know how to fight for what I believe in, and I'm gonna come and teach you too. It's like also leadership, right?
It's a leadership kind of he teaches like leadership and maybe like men's toughness a little bit. Like I don't know exactly toughness. How to classify him, but it is like that type of teaching.
It's definitely not like physically different from the Jordan Peterson experience.
Definitely. Physically very different.
High voice.
Mentally, they're very similar. And I think at the heart of it, there is a Western supremacy. Like they think West is number one. And that includes Christianity. It includes like maybe a skew to white. I don't think either of them care about whiteness.
Yeah. In the army, in the U.S. Army, they're like very, you know, they're not racist anymore in that way. Like lots of they have a way to incorporate black soldiers into their. Like everybody's American here and we're all on the same side.
You have to, just like the Sikh, just like Sikhs in the Indian Army,
Yes.
Are you kidding me?
Yes.
They're the army. So you're not going to discriminate against them. They're it. It's like there's too many black people to start discriminating against them. It's ridiculous. They can't do it.
Yeah, like that's your experience of it. And it's funny because it's like in probably the U.S. Army is the one of the only places that are kind of more integrated, right? Like,
it really? Right? So you think more than France and stuff? I mean, yeah.
No, I mean in the U.S. Like, U.S. Like, yeah, no, as a soldier on a base, you're probably less likely to experience racism as a black soldier on a base than you are like as a black person on the street.
That's
like,
for sure. You know? They got progressive. It's weird when someone gets progressive for the wrong reason. Because at some point they just said, hey, this is like half of our army, even though it's only 10% of the population. Like, we need to just be so nice.
But like, what bothers me about Jocko too is like, you know, I think there's a difference between a war where you're defending your own border.
Yeah.
You know, and a war where you're going halfway across the world for some oil or whatever, like, so that you're, you know, your military country controls access to oil for other people.
Yeah.
You know,
military occupation. That's what it is. Yeah. Let's call it what it is. It's a military occupation. They took over Iraq and destroyed it for 9 years. They're, you know, trillions of dollars in debt. Iraq is destroyed. America's in debt. And their people all have PTSD and they don't want to pay for the health care of the damage that it did. So, this is the
war of choice. So, you know. So then what kind of hero is, you know, what kind of heroism is that? Like, what kind of heroic example is that?
No, it's nonsense. I mean, it's terrible. This is a great thing that she keeps bringing up in the Marielle Trump book, where she's just talking about how this kind of tough love attitude, it just messes up. It kind of just digs them deeper into this hole of being these negative, bitter, cranky people. And Buddhism, which we already talked about, I actually got a degree in Buddhism. It was amazing, from Harvard online. I just finished it during COVID.
I heard about that on CoffeeZilla.
I have a degree from Harvard. I definitely put that on my Tinder too. My Tinder says I'm a graduate from Harvard University, which I technically have. And one of the great things they teach between the East and the West is that in the West, they believe in original sin. And in the East, they believe in original perfection. This tough love attitude that we have over here, where God is up there looking down on you and judging you and watching you masturbate, whatever, in the East, and this is in Hinduism too, where in the East, according to tantric belief, according to Buddhist belief, you are God. And the number one thing you're supposed to do is use loving kindness to get through your life in the happiest, most meaningful way possible. But it is like a loving kindness based philosophy. That's the Dalai Lama's meditation that he does. So
Jocko, I think of Jocko as having been made famous by Tim Ferriss, who's like a big podcaster and like self-help writer too. But like the other guy, Peterson, and lots of these other guys are kind of made famous by Rogan.
Yeah, Jocko too, no? Because Jocko goes on Rogan.
Oh, is Jocko on Rogan too?
Oh, yeah, you can see Rogan, his clips are viral from Rogan.
Okay, because Rogan is like, and Rogan hates vegans. Like that, you watch Rogan for any length of time and you're going to hear him attack veganism.
Yeah, I don't think he hates vegans. It's just as a comic, there's like your ego is a comic sometimes, and even as a writer.
Oh, you understand it as a comic. Okay, you can give me some insight on this.
I'll tell you what's happening, I think, because I did see the other guy who made the document. He made a vegan documentary. He was on Joe Rogan, and Joe Rogan let him really speak his mind.
Oh, okay.
And I appreciated it. But I agree with you. It's like, but I think what's happening with Joe Rogan as a comic, it's okay. Is his stand-up great? I know like his people have to say that it is. It's okay. I think he's just starting to do his best stand-up now. But I think what happens is people will get caught up in doing like, let's say, a vegan joke. So like you've done a vegan joke. It's okay. But I think in his mind, he's just like, man, my vegan jokes kill. I don't care what anyone says.
You get a good response.
You're the best. If anyone's mad, it's because my vegan jokes are so tight that they can't handle it. And it's like the vegan jokes are okay. They're like a little weird. It is weird. Like I agree with you. Like they're just like, he's going after vegans for being like, what are you soft? Like you're a loser. Like it's like that kind of stuff. Yeah. It's not the best bit. I mean, it's not a strong enough bit, I think, even as a premise, but he's attached to it and he keeps doing it. It's fine. I mean, I don't think it's ever going to be that funny. The funny one though, I like the guy in Toronto. There's a vegan protest out of his restaurant. There's one guy, he owned a restaurant called Antler, I think. It's like a high-end meat restaurant where he hunts his animals. And Joe Rogan made this guy famous too. But anyway, there's a vegan protest outside. and he went to the window and started eating meat. And I thought that was so funny. Like, that's a great bit. And that's a great bit that got him on Joe Rogan. Like, I think he deserves that. That's a good vegan bit. Joe Rogan's, I don't know, it's like every special, he's got to do 5-10 minutes on veganism. And it's, I don't think people are really agreeing with it that much. They're just kind of, you know, it's whatever.
Yeah, well, it's his thing. People like him. But what, so, okay.
But he's so cool in other regards, though. Like, with psychedelics, I think he's on the right side of history. And I think he's doing great work on that front. But then, yeah, with the vegan set, I know, it's dumb. I don't, who's, you know, offended who I like by it, on, is anyone offended?
I like on psych- There's a lefty that I like on psychedelics. See, anyway, anything good, you can find a lefty version, or I do anyway. His name is Gabor Mate. Have you heard of him?
Oh, he's amazing. But I wouldn't call Joe Rogan a right wing person, though. And maybe we should.
Well, you got look at it statistically. There's a couple of comedians, actually. I think they're called the Serfs, S-E-R-F-S.
I've seen that video, yeah. I've seen their stuff.
And they did this kind of like, you know, he interviewed these lefties, you know, two of them.
Fair enough.
Twice each. And in that same period, like these 80 right wingers,
I know.
And some of them 6 times each.
So here's what I would say to that. Okay. So this is an issue where people, I think, on the left get very like guilt by association, cancel everyone. Like, I don't think Joe Rogan is smart enough to know.
He's clearly like an open-minded person, and that's why people like talking to him. And right? He's just super open.
Fair enough, right?
Whoever's talking to him, he'll agree with almost.
But yeah, he's kind of like a blank slate interviewer where he kind of lets his guests come on and say whatever they want. Now, the thing that I think happened with all that, with their number skewing, and I think he's balancing it out now, but what happened was these right-wing maniacs, they are 10 times more aggressive and 10 times more hardworking than the left. That's why 20% of them can run us. They're basically the upper class. If you think about the Indian caste system too, the conservatives are the top. They're the rich people, and they want to conserve things the way they are.
Gandhi said something like that. He said something like, you know, there's 40,000 British here, and there's 400 million of us. So if we didn't want them here, they wouldn't be able to rule us.
I mean, Kanye said that too. Remember, Kanye got in trouble for saying that. And I guess the mentality, like what I think they're trying to say is, these people didn't come and physically conquer us. They conquered our minds and then were kind of doing. So I think the left is, I find, not as hardworking.
No, you know, I'll take it. Whatever. You know, I'm here. Like, you want to say something to the left? Like, I'm
saying it. Like, here's the difference. Here's why Joe Rogan has 80% more right wing people, or he did, because right wing people are aggressive and they're messaging him. There's that too. I mean, the left has just been lazy on online media. They're obsessed with TV and stuff, and there's like no hits there. Online media, the right wing took it, man. Whole internet is just full of right wing people. So the right wing thing blew up on the internet way before the left. They have the hits. They're messaging Joe Rogan probably every day. They're telling Joe Rogan how great he is. I don't think he's smart enough to know the politics, really. Now, after a year of this kind of criticism from the Serfs, he, I think, balanced out. I don't know. I mean, he's really cut down on, he hasn't had Jordan Peterson on in like a year or two, maybe, or something, but.
Well, Jordan was in Russia.
I know. Yeah, I know.
All meat diet, probably.
Yeah, I know. Right? What a weird, that's so weird, man. Did you ever see the clip where Jordan Peterson's trying to, he's on Fox News talking about how the father-daughter dance is getting shut down and how that's going to destroy the culture? Have you seen that?
No, I didn't see that.
It's so good. It's like Fox and Friends morning show. And they were like, the father-daughter dance was shut down due to lack of attendance. It wasn't even shut down because people protest. It was like lack of attendance. And then they bring on Jordan Peterson so mad at like 6 a.m, like, this will destroy everything. I mean, a father should teach his daughter what love is and what the first experience of love. And it's a beautiful experience. Why do they shut it down?
The sound of that at all, man.
So creepy, dude. What? Hey, can you maybe you just be a creep and everything's not a left-wing conspiracy? How about everyone just thinks you're fucking weird, dude? It's not all right left-wing conspiracy. His communism shit, he's a maniac with the communism. What a sad thing he did, where he reinstalled a meaningless, like just a nonsense fear, a propaganda. He reinstalled it into a new generation of kids. I mean,
see, I don't know if it's a nonsense fear. So here's, I read this amazing book. Okay. I read this amazing book recently called The Reactionary Mind. You might like it. I don't know. And it's, so the guy's arguing, he goes back to like the French Revolution, and he says, you know, the French Revolution, they were trying the declaration that everybody is equal. Like that was like a big change in human history that they would, that somebody would say that and like formalize it in 1794. And that made conservative, that's when the conservative movement starts too. So that's when like this Edmund Burke, this British parliamentarian, he's like, this is going to destroy everything because you're basically saying that anybody can rule. You're saying any, you know, that means no, my cook is not going to cook for me. My babysitter is not going to babysit. Right. My shoemaker is not going to shoemake because they're all going to think they should be in charge.
Of course.
So then he goes through history, this author, and he shows, he basically argues that whatever movement there is for equality, whatever the left is doing, conservatives oppose. That's what conservatism is. In any moment, whatever the movement is, like Jordan is really incensed about trans rights, right? Because it's like, you're going to have to call somebody by their preferred pronoun. Like, very upsetting, you know? It's gonna, what's going to happen? But that's the thing. So I actually think that like, because for example, like Bernie Sanders or, you know, all of these different things where they're like, why don't we have healthcare in America? Like we have in other parts of the world. And it's like that conservatives don't like that.
They don't like that.
You're challenging this order.
Yeah. So right? They're whatever basically, they're wrong though. What are you defending them? I mean, that's what I mean by the communist scare, the red scare.
Yeah, what I'm saying is like a conservative will see in any movement to equality like a mortal danger.
Yeah, and they're crazy for doing that and they need to be told that's wrong.
No, I agree they're crazy for doing that. Yeah. What I'm saying is though, like he's fulfilling an important, by trying to turn young people off of communism, he's doing great work for the system, like in a way.
Look, it's the system that helps him. Again, he's upper class, so it's the system that benefits him. He's saying, don't touch it. It'll destroy everything. It'll destroy everything for you. There's 80% of the population is maybe not exactly where you are, and it's not going to benefit them. And this communism stuff, let's talk about the damage done by that, the fear of communism I'm talking about. America was never going to become communist. We know that now.
Right. Never.
But
never.
It was a conspiracy, and it's known to be a conspiracy. Everyone knows that. And yet, what is this fear that we have to keep restarting this? Oh, the communists are coming. That's wild. This is the reason they don't have healthcare. This is the reason they don't have like an education system. And they, you know, like they have issues over that, I think. And I think he did a big disservice on that one.
I would never, I totally agree with you. I guess all I'm saying is that's kind of intrinsic to what conservative thinking is.
That's what they are, and that's what they have to do. I guess.
But you don't see Rogan on that track is what
I don't. I think Rogan is basically, hey, you know what the problem, this again, the problem with the left now, he brings on Bernie Sanders and everyone says, oh my god, can you believe he did Joe Rogan? Hey, idiots, do you want to win?
I'm with you on that.
I think the criticism that serfs do, I mean, I don't know what their ultimate thing was on the serfs. I don't remember. But at the end of the day, like, I think that's great to be like, hey, man, you're putting on 80% right-wing people. I think it's because he's self-admittedly not very bright about politics. These guys are aggressive. They have the numbers. So they're just pushing him. The left, I don't think Abby Martin is saying to Joe Rogan, hey, it's really important that you bring me on again. If she did, she'd be on, I think, more often. He thinks she's great, and maybe she's in Russia or whatever. These other guys, I don't think they just got on the train quick enough. That's why their numbers aren't as big, and that's why they're coming late to the game. But that's a little bit on them. That's I think, their problem. Because they'll say, like, they'll say in Gujarati. Do you speak Gujarati, or what's your background?
No, I'm from Kerala, man.
Kerala, cool. Wow, this probably fully educated state and communist a little bit, I've heard.
Communist, yeah.
That's exactly amazing.
Which is why I don't have the fear of communism.
Yeah, no, and you shouldn't. it's fine. It's not even communism. It's just a state that's operating slightly, not that, like they're operating a little differently. I don't think it's, you know, people just give it.
I appreciate that. Yeah, to get a stamp of to get a Gujarati stamp of approval.
Look, at the end of the day. At the end of the day, these Gujaratis, just like all these right-wing people, they think life is about money and tough love and this and that, and they're miserable, man. I mean, you look at how Kerala's running, financially it's more efficient. I think this is a big issue from the left, too, where they criticize the right for being mean. It's like, criticize them for wasting money. Then they'll learn. Yeah. They don't care about bombing you. They don't care about Iraqi people. But if you tell, but you got to just stay on the fact that it was like, hey, how many trillion in debt to China? You like, you just gave your next enemy all your money. You screwed this up. But
can't we get along? Like, what about where does loving kindness meditation fit in? Like,
that's it. Really, that's exactly it. The loving kindness. The Dalai Lama says collaboration is 10 times cheaper than competition. And this,
yeah,
we got to go and bomb Iraq. That is the most damaging thing you can do. And yet, again, with Jocko's book, with stuff that Jordan Peterson, it says, it's like that's the mentality that they're operating with of like, we have to go and attack. We have to engage the enemy and keep them on their toes.
Well, yeah, and that was one of the things in your video that I really like, because you kept going back to where Jocko's like, make no mistake, war is hell. Yeah. War is hell. And you were like, yeah, but...
don't do it.
Why do you... Don't do
that. Don't do it. No one told you to do it. So just don't do it. So yeah, crazy, good. Man. I mean, honestly, he's brainwashed too, right? Like, we're talking 18 yeah. years old, 20 years old. He started military training. What does he know? Yeah. He's an ape.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, I mean, honestly, like, yeah, he's a nice person, I'm sure. Inside, that's where I think Goggins, to me, seemed a little nicer, where Goggins was more about, we should be our best. Whereas yeah. I found with Jocko, especially the way he just rewrites the story of how he killed this guy. So just for reference for people listening, he has a book called Extreme Ownership. And the main story from that book is a time when he's in Iraq. I mean, he was a military leader in Iraq. He had his own, like the equivalent of platoon. One of his guys made a mistake and killed an Iraqi friendly soldier, but just killed him by mistake. And basically Jocko just puts on, like, basically says, I took extreme ownership. And by extreme ownership, he means no court martial, no money, no time off, just I'll fix the problem myself. That's his extreme ownership. It's the equivalent of getting into a car accident and killing someone and saying, don't worry, I'll drop the body at the, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. That's not the ownership. The ownership doesn't stop there. You killed the person, right. His family. Like, what about all that? And also, you're in Iraq. It's a waste of time. You're not going to take any ownership of that. It's just that, but that's the mentality that they have, I guess, where it's like, we're here doing the right thing by God. Therefore, if one person dies, that's okay.
Right.
And yeah, the loving kindness is, I think, a much better way to live and to think about it.
So what are you writing now? You've been telling me about something that you're right. You've got a contract and you're writing.
I'm writing one show for CTV. It's a sitcom. It's a lot of fun. It's with my writing partner, Neil Honda. We're working on it. You know, we're ready. We basically got a development deal to write a Bible in 2 episodes. So that's almost done. And hopefully we'll be making a TV show soon. But you never know. The network knows. But it's a great show. I'm very proud of it. And then I just got another... had a meeting with another producer about a kid's show I wrote. It's not a kid's show. It's like a teen adventure. And okay. I went in thinking that he would go looking for funding. Like he would be like, okay, cool. I got this. I'll go and ask people for funding. But I went in, this is like 2 weeks ago. I went in and he said, you know what? We're just going to fund it in-house because we like to have a strong package going in. So we like to shoot our own pilots. So, I mean, he's doing exceptionally well. They've won like 50 Emmys, I think, in the company. It's called Sinking Ship. They're the producers of Dino Dana, and they've done really well. And they have an animation team that's ready to work and is looking for cool projects. So, that's the other one.
So, what do you do? What you start with a theme, or like, what do you? How do you? What? Why do you? What? Like, where do you start?
Where do I start? Because
I don't mean like creatively. I guess I mean politically. Like, where are you?
Well, let me see if
does
I.
Your,
Yeah, good.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I can answer maybe both at the same time. Have you ever seen, you listen to Alan Watts, I'm sure, right? Alan Watts?
I know that name. I'm sure I've either read something.
He teaches this old Hindu philosophy. We kind of touched on it about how we're gods. Like, it's not out there. God is not out there. It's very Hindu philosophy that we're gods. We're gods basically playing, like living in a dream or playing these adventure games. And the whole point of the game is like loving kindness and to see if you can raise yourself to a higher consciousness. Mm-hmm. It sounds wacky when you say it in English. This is Hinduism. I mean, it's weird. Yeah. It is weird saying it here because it gets associated with like crystal healing type of stuff. But it's official. It's legit. It's Buddhism. I just took the class. It's like, that's what it is. And the belief is that this life, is basically stories. Thomas King just did actually.
The Truth About Stories. Yeah, I know that well.
Right. So you know his Massey Hall lectures. He talks about this too. Yeah. So basically life is a story vehicle maybe, or like just a vehicle. Our bodies are maybe just a vehicle through which a god is playing a video game called life. And so we're playing it. And then the most fun thing you can do is make adventures for other people. And that's what these stories are. Or TV shows or stories, they're like little adventures that someone could go on. And there's like a little bit of spiritual growth attached to it, but it's not supposed to be about that. It's supposed to be just about pure entertainment. I mean, it's both at the same time, really. I mean, if you think about Hollywood, even the way they teach you to write is they basically say that your climax can only happen after a part in a movie called The Dark Night of the Soul. And The Dark Night of the Soul is basically the point where... What's that?
Right? This is the Save the Cat.
Yeah, Save the Cat. Everyone. I mean, at this point, everyone. Dan Harmon wrote Rick and Morty. He has an 8-point story structure, but every story structure has this beat. And yes, Save the Cat is the one who named the beat. They call it Dark Night of the Soul. He might have gotten it from somewhere else too. But that's basically the point where the hero... is killing the part of themselves that they needed to kill, like basically destroying a part of their ego, maybe.
They get some insight
that
they lacking. The problem of the story is that there's something they don't understand that's causing them to suffer unnecessarily.
Yeah. So there's a great lecture called The Hero's Two Journeys. And they basically say that one story is the action level, like the physical world, what we're living in. And then the other story is the character development. So your theme is actually the theme of any story is supposed to be the character growth that the main character is going through. That's technically the theme. And that's the thing that gets solved, or that's the thing that gets overcome in the Dark Night of the Soul moment beat. And so in a way you could say that like life, that's what your life is supposed to be according to Hinduism. It's just this endless spiritual, it's just spiritual growth video games where you just go over and over.
So let me tell you how I connect, like how I think of what I do and how that connects. Cause I always think of it as like propaganda, and it's like everywhere around you, there's like a series of, you could say, stories that are being told to you by the powerful that are in their interest and not necessarily in yours, which is why like the North Korea thing, I go through periods where I'm like, I don't know anything about this. I know what people are telling me, but I don't have any knowledge of this.
Right.
And so for me, it's like, where is, how can I approach like the truth about whether it's a political situation or, you know, a human interaction or like even something, some problem, like how to treat my children. Right. Or like
One side's propaganda is another side's thing. Like, I mean, is another side's like beautiful story, whatever. Like if you're right wing and you think that's how the world should work, and I'm saying right wing loosely, but let's just say you're Jocko or Jordan Peterson and you think like, then you're going to look for stories that support that worldview.
But let me tell, I believe, first of all, as a scientist, I believe that there are stories out there that are more consistent, right, with the material world. So I believe that there's a thing, there is some truth, which is to say, like, we should be able to agree on stories or some elements of these stories. So it's not like they're not incommensurable. But let me tell you another little anecdote, because I got a real insight into Jordan Peterson from a friend of mine that I met through martial arts. Like there's a martial art from Kerala called Kalaripayattu.
Wow.
I
don't know. That's amazing. Cool. Of course.
It's like the Chinese say that it was potentially someone who practiced this, a Bodhidharma who taught the Shaolin monks. So anyway, it's animal movements and weapons. And I studied it for about 10 years. And one of my teachers has a son, and the son took Jordan's class.
Okay.
And he wrote an essay where he was talking about like, someone interviewed Jordan Peterson and they said, you know, what if you understood history in terms of like oppression and overcoming oppression? And Peterson said, well, good luck with that. Mm-hmm. And Hans, the guy who was quoting it, he said, you know, it's interesting because Peterson is saying something really profound here. He's saying whether it's true or not doesn't matter, because if you have that attitude that the world is all oppression, you're not going to be very successful in your life. So yeah. He doesn't kind of care about the truth. And for me, my thinking is it doesn't matter whether it's helpful or not.
Yeah.
It only matters if it's true, you know?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
If it's true, you've got to adapt your life to that truth. You can't tell yourself something that's not true because it's inconvenient.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, they are... See, this is the colonizer's tricks, brother. I mean, they basically come in, conquer a place, and say, this is the most efficient way. It's the only way. We came and helped the savages. Like, we're not... I mean, this mentality that this is the only way to live, let's say, and mm-hmm. the story... Like, think about what a re-education camp does, as an example. And this is going to sound extreme, maybe, on my part, to go straight to a re-education camp, but... Their whole mentality in re-education camp is, though, you know, and I've seen footage of people coming out of the ones from China. It's basically like, hey, if you want to survive here, you're gonna stop being a terrorist or like stop being a little radical, and you're gonna do what is supportive for us, and that's the best way for you to survive. So now you see people who have come out of these concentration camps. We just talked on Friday or Saturday on the CoffeeZilla channel, and we were watching a video of someone showing like people in Xinjiang getting beat up, and a Chinese diplomat saying, "I cannot see this. I do not see this." He can't see it. It's like this doesn't support my survival right now. It's not true. I mean, this at Mehdi Hassan too. He brought up a bunch of people and from the Chinese government or high up diplomats. They're on stage, and he says, "What do you say about the million plus Muslim Uyghurs that are in jail?" And they just said, why would someone do that? I don't know. I don't think that's true. And then the first three questions are Uyghur survivors saying, hey, my family's still there. I haven't talked to my son in 15 years. Can you tell me about that? Like that mentality of like, do what the truth is. I mean, at the end of the day, like going back to Jordan Peterson, he's saying that he has this tough individualism, but it's a tough individualism after you have brainwashed yourself to conform to the culture. So like, it's like tough individualism after you've brainwashed yourself to be a good boy and do this, you know, like even when I went to school in India, they had a very similar mentality. It was an old British school, and they were like, okay, you have to iron your pants and wear a shirt and have an undershirt. They had that system down, polish your shoes every day. And I remember I asked them once, like, why are we wearing this? And you know, like, we're in India, like, why are we just wearing our own clothes? And it's just one of those things where you go, like, this is how you survive. It's the only way to survive is to conform to what's
working. Way of showing us that you're submissive or whatever.
Yeah, like submissive and part of the system. So it's weird. I mean, that's the thing with conservative, like that kind of mentality. And I hate to say the word conservative because people do get offended when you just say conservative as a blanket thing. But I guess it's more like everyone lock and step. You know, follow these rules kind of attitude. Maybe it's just like, it looks tough on the surface, but it does rely on like internally just kind of shutting down your individuality maybe a little bit. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Like the idea of individual freedom in a conservative context is like freedom for us, not for you. Right.
Yeah.
Like, and there's always going to be some people that are free and some people that are.
It's kind of like saying, hey, you have the freedom to do what's natural for a man or a woman to do. That's what the freedom that you have. And then I'm going to dictate what's natural for you to do. So that's.
Yeah.
You know what
yeah,
I mean? Like, yeah. And that's a big part of what he teaches, I think, is very much like.
Lobsters do this, so you have to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Or he's like looking for studies that are like, I found a study that says women who don't have kids are unhappy. It's like, hey, I get it. Hey, dad, some people don't want to have kids. Okay, will you drop it? Who cares? Or if you really want white women to have kids again, pay for it. Like, once women are educated, you're getting one, maybe two kids. These people will bomb the schools in a country and be like, look at them, they have 10 kids. What did you think, man? You want to educate?
Anytime wars, refugee situations, people always have more kids. It always happens.
Basically, as soon as women have freedom, you're getting one, maybe two. That's it, brother. What is this? Nine kids.
All right, man. That was good.
All right, man.